defendant might or might not have been capable of.
Yes, the judge replied, and no doubt they'll contradict each other and get us absolutely nowhere. The witness is a woman of uncommon good sense, it seems to me, Mr. Picton, and it was you, after all, who argued to have her impressions included in the record. I'll let her answer.
Thank you, Your Honor, Mr. Darrow said. Well, Mrs. Wright?
Taking a moment to think it over and stealing another look at Libby as she did, Mrs. Wright said, I hadn't counted on being asked that question.
Oh, Mr. Darrow said. Well, I'm sorry to surprise you, but try to come up with an answer all the same. Did you ever, during all the years that you were in her employ, suspect that Mrs. Hatch was capable of murdering her own children?
Mrs. Wright looked to Mr. Picton, and the struggle what was going on in her mind was plain to see in her face.
What the hell's Darrow doing? Mr. Moore whispered. I thought that was supposed to be one of our questions.
He's seen what the jury's inferring from her testimony, the doctor answered. He wants to rattle her by attempting to force her to make an outright accusation.
He leaned forward anxiously.
But will she be rattled?
Mr. Darrow folded his arms.
I'm still here, Mrs. Wright.
Louisa Wright wrung her hands for a few seconds. It's not the kind of thing to bandy around.
Really? Mr. Darrow replied. It seems to me you've done an awful lot of bandying already. I wouldn't think this would give you any pause. But let me make it easier for you. You claim that Mrs. Hatch was engaged in what sounds like it was a pretty torrid affair with the Reverend Parker. Don't you think it would have been easier for her to run off with him once her husband was dead if she didn't have three children to drag along?
That's a hard way to put it, Mrs. Wright answered, glancing at Libby again.
If you can think of an easy way to put such accusations, Mr. Darrow said, you just let me know.
Well, Mrs. Wright?
You don't understand, the woman said a little more defiantly.
And what don't I understand?
Mrs. Wright leaned forward, eyeing Mr. Darrow. I have children, sir. My husband and I had two before he was killed in the war. I can't imagine what would drive a woman to do something like that. It isn't natural. For a mother to end any life that she brought into the world, it just isn't natural.
Your Honor, I'm forced to ask for your help here, Mr. Darrow said. The question was, I think, pretty close to clear.
Mrs. Wright, Judge Brown said, you're only being asked for your opinion.
But it's a terrible thing, Your Honor, to accuse someone of, Mrs. Wright said.
Mr. Darrow, smelling her fear, moved in closer to the witness stand. But the state is accusing her, Mrs. Wright, and you're a witness for the state. Come now. You knew that Mrs. Hatch had been written out of her husband's will, that the only way she could inherit his money was if the children died. Didn't that make you at all suspicious?
All right, then, the woman finally hollered. It does make me suspicious, but it's still an awful thing to accuse someone of.
It does make you suspicious, Mrs. Wright? Mr. Darrow asked quietly. Or it did. Let me see if I follow you. You say that Mrs. Hatch had a violent temper sometimes. You say that she was romantically involved with the Reverend Parker. And you say that she wanted her husband's money. And all of this, you now say, is grounds for believing that she killed her children. Although you didn't make any such accusations at the time.
Of course I didn't. Mrs. Wright protested. I was only asked for my opinion a week or so ago.
Exactly, Mrs. Wright, Mr. Darrow answered, very satisfied. Tell me, have you ever known any other women who raised a hand to their children?
Mrs. Wright's face grew puzzled. Yes, of course.
Ever heard of any who were unfaithful to their husbands? Shifting nervously, Mrs. Wright tried to rein her voice in.
One or two, perhaps.
How about any that married rich old men to get their hands on their money?
Perhaps.
Do you think any of them would have been capable of murdering their own children?
What do you mean?
Just what I say, Mrs. Wright.
I don't know.
But you've got pretty definite suspicions about Mrs. Hatch. Now, I mean.
I don't understand you.
Oh, I think you do, Mr. Darrow replied, coming in close again. Mrs. Wright, isn't it true that you only think Mrs. Hatch might have killed her children now because the assistant district attorney and his investigators suggested to you that she might have done it?
Your Honor, Mr. Picton shouted, popping up, if the counsel for the defense is implying that the witness is lying—
Your Honor, I am implying no such thing, Mr. Darrow answered. I'm simply trying to trace the origins of Mrs. Wright's suspicions and to show that they, like so many other things in this case, seem to lead back to the assistant district attorney and to the people who are advising him in this matter.
Mr. Darrow, Judge Brown said, I thought we had seen the last of insinuation here.
And so we have, Your Honor, Mr. Darrow answered obligingly. I have no further questions for this witness.
There was a long pause, during which Mr. Picton watched Mr. Darrow sit back down with a combination of anger and temporary confusion in his face.
Mr. Picton, Judge Brown finally said, do you wish to redirect?
Mr. Picton turned to the bench.
No, Your Honor.
Then the witness is excused, the judge said, at which the shaken Mrs. Wright made her way down from the stand. Judge Brown looked to Mr. Picton again.
Do you have another witness for us, sir?
Trying to get himself fully composed, Mr. Picton looked anxiously to the door and then to Sheriff Dunning, who only shrugged once.
"Actually, Your Honor," Mr. Picton replied, "the state's next witness has apparently not arrived yet. He was due to be escorted to town by two of Sheriff Dunning's deputies, but I don't know."
Just then a young boy slipped through the mahogany doors. He was wearing the uniform of the Western Union Company, and in his hand he was clutching an envelope. After asking the guard at the door a question, he was directed toward Mr. Picton's table and made his way down the aisle. Seeing him, Mr. Picton said,
"This may be word of the witness now, Your Honor, if I may have just a moment."
"A moment, Mr. Picton,"
the judge said, sitting back. The delivery boy passed by our two rows of seats, then handed the envelope to Mr. Picton and asked him to sign for it. Doing so quickly, Mr. Picton tore the telegram open and read it quickly. Then he read it again, as if its contents made no sense to him. Finally, on the third reading, his face lost all its color, and he sank into the chair behind him.
"Picton," the doctor whispered, watching him. "What is it?"
Judge Brown leaned forward in his chair, looking both concerned and a little irritated.
"Mr. Picton, are you well, sir?"
Your Honor, Mr. Picton breathed, struggling to get back to his feet.
Staring at the floor underneath him without really coming to see it, Mr. Picton finally caught his breath, cleared his throat, and looked up.
"I'm sorry, Your Honor. At this time, the state was to have called the Reverend Clayton Parker. He was due to take the early train this morning in the company of two of Sheriff Dunning's deputies. Apparently there was an accident."
"An accident?" the judge echoed. "What kind of an accident?"
Pausing and looking at the telegram again, Mr. Picton said slowly,
"Apparently, Reverend Parker fell under the wheels of an approaching train at the Grand Central Terminal this morning. He was severely injured and taken to a nearby hospital. He died there 45 minutes ago."
The news hit the room as hard as the train must have hit the Reverend. The people in the galleries, some of who'd been members of Parker's congregation, broke into open commotion and a few were moved to tears. As for our group, we were all too stunned to say or do anything at all. There was no confusion among us, of course. We all knew that there was no chance that the death had actually been an accident. Getting killed by a train at Grand Central was almost impossible unless somebody was helping you. Somebody experienced at such things, somebody strong, somebody crazy enough to pull such a job in the middle of a large crowd, and somebody who wasn't worried about the presence of two sheriff's deputies. Somebody wound up on Bernie, for instance. Somebody like a Hudson Duster. As for Libby Hatch, she erupted with a short, loud sound that I could have sworn was a laugh. But when I looked over, she had her face buried in her hands and seemed to be crying. Judge Brown went to work restoring order, though he did so more gently than usual. As the crowd started to quiet down, he looked around the room with a somber face.
"The court is indeed sorry to receive this news," he said. "Reverend Parker was well known and respected in this community, despite any allegations that have been made in this room. Under the circumstances, I would suggest that we call a recess until 2 o'clock, at which hour, Mr. Picton, you can call your next witness, or if you need more time."
Still looking very shaken, Mr. Picton began to shake his head. "No, Your Honor, thank you. The state will be ready at 2 o'clock, with its next witness." The judge banged away, and as soon as he'd left the courtroom, the place came alive again. Mr. Picton collapsed back into his chair, and none of us made any move toward him, not really knowing what we could possibly say. Once again, things were not going the way he'd planned, and the future of our case looked like it was in doubt, especially in light of the way Mr. Darrow had handled Louisa Wright, a witness whose testimony wouldn't ever receive corroboration now. Knowing all this, Mr. Picton just sat there in his chair for what seemed a long time, staring at the telegram in his hand. Finally, he lifted his face and looked over to the rest of us, and to one of us in particular. "Well, Doctor," he said very quietly, "I hope you can be ready by 2, because I can't let the jury sleep on what they've heard today." He paused, raising an eyebrow. "You're all we've got left." The doctor nodded, realizing, it seemed, just what a tight spot he was now in. But his voice, when he spoke, was very controlled, calm even. "That's all right, Mr. Picton," he said, touching the hair under his lower lip. "I may have learned a thing or two from our friend Darrow."
Chapter 47.
Coming back into the courtroom that afternoon, I took note of a change in the positioning of the guards in the place, one what didn't make much of an impression on me at the time. The big man who'd usually stood behind Iphigenia Blaylock was now at the door, while Henry, our old friend with the narrow head and the slow brain, was standing inside the oak railing near the defense table. Writing the switch off to each man wanting a change of pace, I didn't, like I say, think much of it. But now, looking back, I can see that it was the first indication of something much more sinister, something that would eventually result in an unexpected and terrible conclusion to the trial. It would have saved a lot of heartache if I could have seen what the shift really signaled, if any of our group could have. But the only one who might have logically been expected to read it correctly was the doctor, and he was much too focused on his coming showdown with Mr. Darrow to pay attention to those kind of seemingly small details. Taking the stand at just past 2, the doctor spent most of the next hour answering Mr. Picton's questions about the work he'd done with Clara Hatch, proceeding from there into a discussion of his assessment of Libby Hatch's mental condition. The jury, like the people in the galleries around them, were pretty obviously disposed to view the doctor's statements with what you might call skepticism when he first began to speak. But as was so often the case when he appeared in court, he slowly began to win at least some of them over with his clear and compassionate statements, especially when it came to the subject of Clara, making it clear that while treating the girl, he'd simply followed his standard procedure for dealing with such cases, and also making it clear just how many similar cases he had dealt with, the doctor painted a picture of a very bright, very sensitive girl, one whose mind had been terribly jumbled but not broken by the events what had occurred on the night of May 31, 1894. His description of Clara had the effect of softening the jury up to the point where they became interested in the details of his medical diagnosis instead of being put off by them. And as he talked about spending long days sitting and drawing with her, making it clear that he'd neither tried to force her to speak nor put words in her mouth once she did begin to communicate, those 12 men became more and more what you might call receptive, so that by the time Mr. Picton began to inquire about Libby Hatch, they were ready to hear whatever the doctor had to say. There was no clever maneuvering involved in all this. The simple fact was that for all the doctor's unusual appearance, his accent, and the strange nature of much of his work, when he talked about children, his attitude was so honest and caring that even the most skeptical types couldn't question that he honestly cared about what was best for his young charges. Mr. Picton's queries about Libby Hatch were all designed for one basic purpose— to show that the woman was calculating, not insane, and that she was very capable of using a variety of methods to get what she wanted. The doctor told about the three different approaches she'd employed to try to gain his sympathy, playing the victim, the seductress, and finally the wrathful punisher, and he explained how none of them was what he called pathological by nature. They were, in fact, methods what were very commonly used by many different sorts of women when they were trying to get the upper hand in a given situation, especially a situation that involved men. Playing devil's advocate for a moment, Mr. Picton asked if a woman's murdering her own kids could really be included as part of such efforts, if it could actually be looked at as her trying to gain greater control over her life and her world. Here the doctor launched into a long recital of similar cases he'd seen and read about over the years, cases where women had indeed done away with their offspring when said kids stood in the way of what their mothers perceived as their own basic needs. Part of this conversation was a long examination of a case we'd all come to know well, the life and killings of Lydia Sherman, Queen Poisoner. The doctor noted some very interesting similarities between that murderess and Libby Hatch. Lydia Sherman had been what the doctor referred to as temperamentally as well as constitutionally unsuited to either marriage or motherhood. But that hadn't stopped her from going hunting for husbands and bearing children over and over. Whenever things had gotten intolerable, as they were always bound to do given her personality, she just killed each family off, instead of accepting that the problem might lie inside herself. The same sort of dynamic, the doctor said, controlled Libby Hatch's behavior. For whatever reason, and he made sure to mention the fact that Libby never would discuss her childhood with him, the defendant just couldn't tolerate the gap between what she wanted and what she thought society expected of a woman. Headstrong and absorbed with her own needs and desires as she was, Libby couldn't let even children stand in the way of her plans. But she also felt a desperate need to have people perceive her as a good woman, a caring mother, a loving wife. Looked at from this angle, the strange story about the phantom Negro on the Charlton Road really wasn't so odd. Only a tale so fantastic could make her look like a hero to the people in her town, instead of a woman who'd murdered three kids what were in her way. But there was nothing, the doctor emphasized, insane in any of this. Members of the male sex very often went to the gallows for similar crimes without anybody ever suggesting that they were crazy. But weren't there differences, Mr. Picton asked, between women and men so far as these things went? Only in the eyes of society, the doctor answered. The world at large didn't want to accept the idea that what most people considered the only truly reliable blood relationship in the world, that between a mother and her children, was in fact anything but sacred. Not done giving voice to the questions he was sure were in the jury's minds, Mr. Picton proceeded to ask why Libby hadn't just abandoned the kids and disappeared to start a new existence somewhere else, the way other women often did. Was it just the money that she expected to get from her husband's estate when they died that had driven her to bloodshed? These questions were designed to let the doctor repeat the main theme of his testimony, to hammer it into the jury's thinking, and the doctor took the opportunity to pound away. Stronger even than Libby's desire for wealth, he said, was the desire to be accepted by the world as a good mother. Every human being, he explained, wants to believe, and wants the rest of the world to believe, that he or she can perform life's most primitive functions.
For women trained by American society, this was especially true. The message to young girls, and here the doctor borrowed from Miss Howard, who had, after all, been responsible for his own realization of the fact, was that if you couldn't attend to the propagation of the species, nothing else you did would really make up for the failure. Libby Hatch had been especially indoctrinated with this belief, probably by her own family. She just could not tolerate being seen as the sort of person who wouldn't or couldn't care for her children adequately. In her mind, it was better that they die than that she be tarred with that particular brush. But, said Mr. Picton, such thinking might be interpreted by some people as insanity, and wasn't it insanity, really, of some kind? No, answered the doctor, it was intolerance. Of a raging, vengeful variety, true, but intolerance had not yet, and to his way of thinking never would be, classified as a mental disorder. Those of us in the first two rows had, of course, heard all this many times in recent weeks, but the doctor and Mr. Picton managed to pump enough new blood into the discussion so that even we became wrapped up in the talk. The effect that it had on the jury was even stronger from the look of them, and that, I guess, is why Mr. Darrow went straight for the throat once Mr. Picton sat down. "Dr. Kreitzler," he said, moving toward the witness box with a hard look on his face, "isn't it true that you and your associates have recently been trying to prove that the defendant is responsible for the unexplained deaths of a number of children in New York City?" Mr. Picton didn't even need to get up. Before he could register an objection, Judge Brown slammed down his gavel, silencing the loud chatter that the question had sparked in both the galleries and the jury box. "Mr. Darrow," he hollered, "I've had just about enough of this kind of irresponsible questioning from both sides. I want to see you and Mr. Picton in my chambers, now." As he got up, the judge turned to the jury box. "And you, gentlemen, would ignore that last question, which will be stricken from the record." Turning again, the judge looked down at the doctor. "The witness may feel free to move about, but you'll still be under oath, doctor, when we get back underway. Let's go, gentlemen." Moving so fast that he didn't look like much more than a black blur, Judge Brown disappeared through the back door of the courtroom, followed quickly by Mr. Darrow and Mr. Picton. As soon as they'd gone, the crowd came alive with animated conversation. The doctor, not wanting to look shocked, slowly rose and drifted over to where we were all sitting. "So, doctor," Lucius said, "I guess this is when the real trial begins."
"He's laying the groundwork for his experts," Marcus added, looking across the room to Mrs. Cady Stanton, Dr. White, and Dr. Hamilton. "He knows he can't come at you with incompetence, so he'll go for the ulterior motive, but I didn't think he'd do it so fast." "It was his only choice," the doctor answered. "If he'd gradually led up to the accusation, the judge never would have allowed him to reach it. This way he at least makes sure that the jury hears his charge. It's worth a lecture in chambers."
"Speaking of his witnesses, it looks like there's more bad doings over there," Cyrus said, pointing to the defense table.
Libby Hatch had gotten up to introduce herself to Mrs. Cady Stanton, and as they shook hands I could make out the old girl saying, "Thank you, thank you," in answer to what were almost certainly some very flattering comments from the defendant, the same sort of comments she'd made to the doctor on first meeting him. "Maybe I should try to break that up," Miss Howard said, as she watched the pair continue to chat. "Now that the subject's been broached, so to speak, I'm sure Mrs. Cady Stanton will understand."
"I wouldn't, Sarah," the doctor said. "Let's not give Darrow any more ammunition by attempting to fraternize with his witnesses."
His black eyes wandered to the back door of the courtroom, and he smiled as he said,
"I can only imagine what's going on in there."
What was going on in there, we later learned from Mr. Picton, was a full accounting to the judge by the assistant district attorney of just what had brought all of us to Ballston Spa. It seemed that Mr. Darrow's private detectives, who, it turned out, were actually Mr. Vanderbilt's private detectives, with help from the Bureau of Detectives in New York and various employees of both the Lying In and St. Luke's hospitals, had put together a pretty good picture of our recent moves with regard to Libby Hatch. The only thing that Mr. Darrow didn't seem to know about was the Linares case, and Mr. Picton made sure he didn't let any information slip on that score.
Judge Brown received all this news in an air of exasperation, and though it didn't make him any better disposed toward Mr. Picton or the rest of us, it did make him all the more determined to keep any unrelated matters out of the record of the case currently being tried. He was very firm with Mr. Darrow about that. The defense could say whatever it wanted to about the doctor's personal or professional motives and methods, but it could not bring up the subject of other allegations or investigations. Mr. Darrow argued that it would be tough to paint an accurate picture of the doctor's true motivations without bringing up those other investigations, but the judge stuck to his guns, as Mr. Picton had predicted he would, and said that the Hatch case had to be tried on its own merits. He warned Mr. Darrow against trying to poison the jury's ears with any more surprise questions what would have to be stricken from the record, but could never, of course, truly be stricken from the jury's memories. And then the three men returned to the courtroom, where the defense's examination of the doctor continued. "Dr. Kreitzler," Mr. Darrow said, once the galleries had gotten themselves resettled, "what exactly is your occupation, sir?" "I am an alienist and a psychologist," the doctor answered. "I work in most of the hospitals in New York in that capacity. In addition, I perform mental competency assessments for the city when asked, and I appear as an expert witness at trials such as this one. Most of my time, however, is spent at an institute for children which I founded several years ago." Mr. Darrow, looking eager, was about to ask another question when the doctor showed just what he'd meant when he said he'd learned a few lessons from the counsel for the defense. "I should add, however, that I am not currently serving as the active director of the Institute due to a court investigation into its affairs, which was initiated following the suicide of a young boy we recently took in." Looking disappointed at not getting a chance to force this last information out of the doctor, Mr. Darrow asked, "You were, in fact, ordered not to return to your Institute for a period of 60 days, were you not?" "Yes," the doctor answered. "It's not an uncommon action for a court to take under such circumstances. It allows the investigation into what drove the boy to take his own life to be conducted more freely and effectively."
"And has the investigation turned up any answers to the question of why the boy took his own life?"
The doctor lowered his eyes just a bit. "No, it has not."
"That must be particularly frustrating for a man who's spent most of his life trying to help children."
"I don't know that it's frustrating," the doctor answered. "Puzzling, certainly, and distressing."
"Well, I'm no alienist, doctor," Mr. Darrow said, walking over to the jury. "But I'd say that puzzling and distressing, when put together, can add up to frustrating without much trouble. Wouldn't you agree?"
The doctor shrugged. "They might."
"And a person who's frustrated on one front might be tempted to seek satisfaction on another. At least, that's how it's always seemed to me."
Returning to his table, Mr. Darrow picked up a book. "Tell me, do you know of a Dr. Adolf Meyer?" Nodding, the doctor said, "Certainly. He's a colleague of mine, and a friend."
"Children seem to be an area of special interest for him, too, to judge by his writings."
The doctor nodded silently.
"I take it you've read what he has to say about children with what he calls morbid imaginations?"
After another nod from the doctor, Mr. Darrow said, "Maybe you could tell the jury just what that refers to."
"Morbid imagination," the doctor answered, turning to the jury box, "is characteristic of children whose fantasies cannot be controlled, even by conscious exertion. Such children often suffer from nightmares and night terrors, and the condition can even lead in its most extreme variant to delusions."
Picking up a second book, Mr. Darrow walked toward the witness stand.
"How about these two European doctors, Breuer and Freud? You know about them?"
"Yes."
"They seem to have made quite a study of hysteria and its effects. I confess I didn't really know what that word meant until I started in on this volume. I always thought it referred to overexcited ladies."
Quiet laughter floated through the galleries at that, and the doctor waited for it to calm down before he said,
"Yes, The word originated with the Greeks, who thought that violent nervous disorders were peculiar to women and originated in the uterus.
Mr. Darrow smiled and shook his head, putting the books down. Well, we've learned better, haven't we? Just about anybody can be hysterical nowadays. I'm afraid I may unintentionally have driven His Honor pretty close to it.
The crowd laughed a little louder this time, but the judge didn't do anything except give Mr. Darrow an icy stare.
And I do apologize for it, the counselor said, holding up a hand.
Then he looked at the doctor again.
But I'm interested in what these gentlemen, Breuer and Freud, have to say about hysteria. They seem to think it originates in childhood, like the morbid imagination. Doctor, is there any chance that Clara Hatch suffers from either a morbid imagination or hysteria?
I could see the doctor working hard to keep from scoffing at the question.
No, he said, not in my opinion. As I told the state's attorney, Clara has experienced what I refer to as protracted hysterical disassociation. It's quite distinct from the kind of hysteria Breuer and Freud discuss.
You seem awfully sure, after spending how many days with the girl?
10 in all.
Quick work, Mr. Darrow judged, playing at being impressed. How about Paul McPherson, the boy who killed himself at your institute?
The doctor kept his features very still at the mention of the unfortunate kid.
What about him, specifically?
Did he suffer from those pathologies?
I can't say. He was only with us a short time before his death.
Oh, how long?
A few weeks.
A few weeks? Shouldn't that have been enough time for you to formulate an accurate diagnosis? After all, with Clara Hatch, it only took you 10 days.
The doctor's eyes thinned up as he realized where Mr. Darrow was going.
I attend to dozens of children at my institute. Clara, by contrast, had my undivided attention.
I'm sure she did, Doctor. I'm sure she did. And you told her that the work you were doing together would help her. Am I correct?
The doctor nodded.
And did you tell her it would help her mother, too?
In a child like Clara, the doctor explained, the memory of a terrifying experience causes a division within the psyche. She divorced herself from the reality of it by refusing to communicate with the rest of the world.
That's very interesting, Doctor, Mr. Darrow said. But if you'd answer the question?
Pausing and then nodding reluctantly, the doctor replied,
Yes. I told her that if she could bring herself to speak of what happened, it would help her and her mother.
Helping her mother was very important to her, then.
It was. Clara loved her mother.
Even though she seems to think that her mother tried to kill her?
And did kill her brothers?
Without waiting for an answer, Mr. Darrow pressed on.
Tell me, Doctor, when you were working with Clara, who first mentioned the idea that her mother had been the actual attacker on the Charlton Road? Was it you or her?
The doctor reeled back a bit, looking very indignant.
She did, of course.
But you already believed her mother was responsible, is that right?
The doctor was having trouble finding words, a rare sight.
I wasn't certain.
You came all the way to Ballston Spa at the request of the assistant district attorney because you weren't certain?
Let's try the question another way, Doctor. Did you suspect that Clara's mother was responsible for the attack?
Yes, I did.
I see. And so you come to Ballston Spa, and you spend every waking hour with a girl who hasn't spoken to another soul in 3 years. And you use all the tricks and techniques of your profession.
I do not use tricks, the doctor said, getting riled.
But Mr. Darrow didn't pause.
To get this little girl to trust in you and believe that you're trying to help her, while all the time you suspect that her mother was in fact the person who shot her.
and you honestly ask us to believe that none of your suspicions ever bled over into your handling of the child at any time during those 10 days?
The doctor set his jaw so hard that his next words could barely be made out.
I don't ask you to believe anything. I'm telling you what happened.
But again Mr. Darrow ignored the statement.
Doctor, you've described your own mental condition after losing Paul McPherson as puzzled and distressed. Would it be fair to say that you're still puzzled and distressed about it?
Yes.
Puzzled, distressed, and potentially disgraced in the eyes of your colleagues, I'd think, if the investigation shows that Paul McPherson died because he didn't get the amount of care, the amount of time he needed at your institute. For, as you say, you couldn't give that boy your undivided attention. And so he died. And then you come up here, full of guilt about the dead boy and suspicions about the defendant, and you find yourself faced with a young girl whom you can give your undivided attention to, whom you can save from the fate that befell Paul McPherson. But only if there's an answer to the mystery that's kept the girl silent all these years. And so you create an answer.
I created nothing, the doctor protested, grabbing at his left arm without realizing it.
Are you so sure, doctor? Mr. Darrow asked, his own voice rising. Are you certain that you didn't plant the idea in Clara Hatch's mind, as only a clever alienist could, that it was her mother, not some lunatic who disappeared and could never be caught, who was responsible, all so that she can talk and enjoy a happy life again?
Your Honor, Mr. Picton called out, this is blatant badgering of the witness. But Judge Brown only waved him off. Seeing that, Mr. Darrow kept going.
There's just one problem, though, Doctor, one thing that gets in the way. For your scheme, your and the state's scheme, to work, my client has to go to the electrical chair.
But then what does that matter to you? You'll be vindicated.
In your own mind, and in the eyes of your colleagues, the McPherson case will be more than balanced out by the Hatch case. Your precious integrity will be restored, and the state can close the books on an unsolved murder. Well, forgive me, Doctor, but I'm not willing to make that trade. There are tragedies in this life that don't have answers.
Suddenly, in a move what caused Miss Howard, Mr. Moore, Cyrus, and me to gasp, Mr. Darrow grabbed his own left arm, mirroring what the doctor was doing. Then he held it out, making it clear that he somehow knew, the secret of the doctor's past.
Yes, tragedies without answers, Doctor, as you well know. And trying to balance the books isn't going to change that. Tying the guilt for this case around my client's neck won't put movement back into Clara Hatch's paralyzed arm, and it won't bring Paul McPherson back to life. Things just aren't that neat, Doctor, not that explicable. A madman committed a crime and disappeared. A boy walked into a washroom and hanged himself. Horrifying, inexplicable events. But I won't let you and the state nail my client to the cross just because you can't live without explanations. No, sir, I will not do it.
Turning to the jury, Mr. Darrow lifted a thick finger toward the heavens, then let it fall as if he were suddenly completely exhausted.
And I hope, maybe I even pray, that you gentlemen won't do it either.
He took a deep breath and wandered back to his seat.
I have no further questions.
It seemed like a very long time since Mr. Darrow had started talking, and I don't think I ever felt more sympathy for the doctor than I did when he was excused from the witness stand and had to make the long walk back over to where the rest of us were sitting. I knew how he felt, how deeply Mr. Darrow's words had cut into him. And so when he didn't pause at his seat, but just kept moving on toward the mahogany doors, I wasn't at all surprised. I didn't make any move to follow just yet, knowing he'd want to be alone for a few minutes. But as soon as the judge had ordered court recessed until 10 o'clock the next morning, I bolted for the exit, Cyrus and Mr. Moore following close behind me. We found the doctor across the street, standing under a tree and smoking a cigarette.
He made no move at all when we approached, just kept staring at the courthouse with narrow, squinting eyes. Cyrus and I each stood to one side while Mr. Moore faced him head on. "Well, Laszlo," he said, gently but with a smile, "I guess you've got more to learn from him than you thought." The doctor just blew out a smoky sigh and smiled ever so slightly back at his childhood friend. "Yes, John, I suppose so." Then we heard Mr. Picton's voice calling and saw him appear on the courthouse steps with Miss Howard, the Isaacsons, and El Nino. When they caught sight of us, they rushed on over, Mr. Picton smoking his pipe and swinging one fist at empty air. "Damn the man," he said, once he was sure that the doctor was okay. "Of all the blasted cheek, I am sorry, doctor. He was wrong, terribly wrong." The doctor's eyes moved to Mr. Picton, while his head remained still. "Wrong?" he said quietly. "Yes, he was wrong about Libby Hatch and this case. But about me?" Shrugging just once, the doctor threw his cigarette into the gutter and began to walk down High Street. Alone. Chapter 48. By midnight on that Thursday, the odds against our convicting Libby Hatch had risen to 100-1 at Canfield's casino. And it wasn't hard to understand why. Mr. Darrow had managed to plant doubts in the jury's minds about Lucius's ballistic testimony even before his own expert, Albert Hamilton, had taken the stand, while Mrs. Louisa Wright's thoughts about a possible romantic motive for the killings had been reduced to unprovable by the sudden and shocking accident what had befallen the Reverend Clayton Parker that morning at Grand Central. Mr. Darrow's very effective questions about the doctor's motivations and techniques had been the icing on this bleak cake, and it was plain to all of us that if things kept going the way they were, defeat was just around the corner. It was no wonder, then, that the atmosphere at Mr. Picton's house that night moved past gloomy until it almost seemed like there was a wake going on. Feeling what you might call resigned about the legal case as such, we began to focus our energies not on what remained to be done in court, which was just about nothing so far as our side was concerned, except for Mr. Picton's official announcement that the state was resting its case, but on what steps we'd need to take to try to get Anna Linares out of the duster's place before Libby made her way back to New York. This meant getting word to Cat by way of the go-between Mr. Moore had engaged, Cat's pal Betty, who was supposedly waiting for us to send a wire to Frankie's joint as soon as we knew it was time for Cat to make her move. Just talking about this possibility played hell with my nerves again, and for a few minutes I actually toyed with the idea of heading down to New York and making sure everything was set and in place. But the sight of me hanging around would, I knew, only make Cat's situation even more dicey, so I stayed put, waiting with the others for what looked like it was going to be the dismal end of our business in Ballston Spa. "And so the new century will bring a new kind of law," was how Mr. Picton summed things up as we all sat out on the front porch of his house late that night. "Proceedings where victims and witnesses are put on trial instead of defendants, where a murderer is identified as a woman instead of an individual. Ah, doctor, it's no step forward, that I can tell you, and I don't think I want to be party to it. If things go on like this, we'll find ourselves in some shadow world where lawyers use the ignorance of the average citizen to manipulate justice the way priests did in the Middle Ages. No, if we lose this case, when we lose this case, it'll be my last, I suspect. I wish I could find some aspect of the affair that might offer you solace," the doctor answered quietly. "But I'm afraid I see none. Darrow is the legal man of the future. That much is indeed clear." "And I'm a relic," Mr. Picton agreed with a nod. Then he laughed once. "A relic at 41. Hardly seems fair, does it? Ah, well, such are the fortunes of the new age. You had to hand it to the man. Unlike many other sporting bloods I've known, he was a genuinely graceful loser. And I don't think there was one of us who failed to appreciate his ability to receive the head what had been handed to him, his own, in court, and still come up philosophical. Except, of course, for Miss Howard, who was always the last member of our company to accept failure or defeat of any kind.
You two can just stop acting like the whole thing's over, she said, sitting on the steps of the porch with a small kerosene lamp and a large map of New York State. Darrow hasn't even opened his case yet, for God's sake. We've still got time to come up with something.
Oh, and what would that be? Mr. Moore asked. Face it, Sarah. You can't fight the prejudices of an entire society and a woman who's as lethally cunning as this one and one of the most vicious gangs in New York and a legal wizard like Darrow all at one and the same time and expect to survive.
He turned to Mr. Picton, lowering his eyes. No offense intended, Rupert. But Mr. Picton only saluted his friend with his pipe. None taken, John, I assure you. You're absolutely right. The man's turned what should have been a disaster into a triumph. My hat's off to him. Yes, well, before you fall all over each other, lining up to pay homage to that legal snake, Miss Howard shot back, do you mind if I suggest some further efforts to salvage our cause? She looked back down at her map. We're still missing the one big piece, somebody who knows something about Libby Hatch's family.
Sarah, Marcus said, pointing toward the courthouse, that jury is not going to be very receptive to a psychological examination of Libby Hatch's childhood context just at the moment.
No, Miss Howard answered, and that's not what I'm proposing. Don't forget she went to the Muhlenbergs as a wet nurse. She had to have had a child, and that child has got to be somewhere, either above or below the ground.
But you looked for days, Sarah, Lucia said. You covered practically every inch of Washington County,
and that may be just where I went wrong, Miss Howard replied. Think about it, Lucius. If you were Libby, and you'd landed yourself the kind of job she had at the Muhlenbergs, would you give them any way to check on the actual facts of your past?
Before Lucius could answer, the doctor asked, What are you saying, Sarah?
That she's too smart for that, Miss Howard answered. If she left some secret behind in her hometown, or even if she only left her family behind, that family would probably have known things that Libby wouldn't have wanted to get out, especially not to people who might hire her as a wet nurse. You've said it yourself, Doctor. The woman's characteristic behaviors must extend back into her childhood. So Libby had to make sure that no one ever knew where she actually came from. On the other hand, she had to say she came from some place that she could actually describe, some place that she knew at least something about to make her story hold water.
That's true, Cyrus said, considering it. She would have covered herself at least that far.
But she could have come from anywhere, Mr. Moore protested.
John, do try to listen for more than 30 seconds running. Miss Howard spat back. She couldn't have come from anywhere. She was a woman who learned that the Muhlenbergs needed a wet nurse from an advertisement. That makes her local. She talked a lot about towns in Washington County, so she must have spent some time there. But if she was trying to conceal her roots, she didn't actually come from Washington County, which means...
Mr. Picton snapped his fingers. Which means you may want to get back down to Troy, Sarah. It's the seat of Rensselaer County, which is to the south of Washington County on the east bank of the river. And Stillwater sits directly across the water from the line that separates the two counties.
Miss Howard slapped her map hard and set the kerosene lamp down, which is exactly what I realized 5 minutes ago, she said with a big, satisfied smile.
It's still a long shot, Marcus said, shaking his head wearily, and you'll have to go tomorrow, which means missing
what? Miss Howard cut in. Darrow's experts, Mrs. Katie Stanton? I know what they're going to say, Marcus, and so do you. It's obvious, maybe even gratuitous at this point. But we do have to work fast. Cyrus, I could use you if you'll come. Stevie, too.
And El Niño to protect you,
the aborigine near shouted, getting caught up in Miss Howard's enthusiasm. Naturally, she answered, rubbing his bushy head. Then she looked to the doctor and Mr. Picton.
Well?
Mr. Picton paused and smoked, shrugging his shoulders.
Nothing to be lost, I suppose. I say go to it.
And you, Doctor? The doctor looked at her with just the faintest trace of hope in his features, more at least than had been there all night.
I'd say that you're all going to need some rest. You'll want to catch the earliest possible train if you intend to have the full day in Troy.
At that, the four of us, Miss Howard, me, Cyrus, and El Niño, got up and headed for the screen door. We weren't exactly confident, I couldn't say that, but the prospect of actually doing something instead of spending another day watching Mr. Darrow turn the Boston courthouse into his private stomping grounds was some kind of a relief, and I was glad to be included in the plan. The reasoning behind it did seem promising, too, even if the time we had to test it wasn't much, and as we went into the house and up the stairs to our respective rooms, I took the opportunity to pay my own sort of compliment to Miss Howard's brainwork. "So," I said as we got to the second floor, "I guess being a spinster detective lady leaves you plenty of time for thinking anyway." I barely got into my room without catching a playful but well-aimed clip to the side of the head. So began a new round of searching the Hudson Valley countryside, one what was both tighter in terms of schedule and less tedious in terms of method than all the riding around Miss Howard, El Nino, and I had done before the start of the trial. We caught the first train to Troy the next morning and managed to get to the Rensselaer County offices without too much trouble. Housed in a building what bore more than a passing resemblance to a bank, the offices looked out over a small park at the center of town, and from the windows in the records room the city didn't look half so ugly as it had from the train. In fact, it had a sort of charm about it, or at least that particular part of it did. I suppose that impression could have just been due to the unseasonably cool weather and my thankfulness at not having to sit in the Ballston courthouse. Whatever the case, I found that the first 2 or 3 hours we spent going through birth and death records passed pretty quickly. There wasn't anybody else in the spacious room with us except for a clerk whose biggest chore, besides fetching files for us, seemed to be staying awake. So we were able to talk and act pretty freely, a fact what quickly led El Nino, who couldn't read English, and me, who wasn't much use with official documents, to start clowning around among the chairs and tables, letting Cyrus and Miss Howard attend to the real work, and only straightening up at those moments when we were told to roust the clerk and tell him to fetch another batch of files and bound records. By 1 o'clock or so, our horseplay had the Aborigine and me pretty hungry, and we set out to find some place to buy boxed lunches for everybody. Our behavior didn't improve any as we went about this job, and on our way back to the county offices with the food we were taken aside by a cop, who, I think, was more bewildered by the sight of El Nino than he was interested in what we were up to. The bull walked us back to the county building just to make sure our story held water, and told Miss Howard not to let us run wild in the streets. I had to resist the temptation to tell him that if such as what we'd been doing was his idea of running wild, he needed to spend some time in New York. After that, he finally left, and we all went outside to the little park to eat. Once we were back in the records room, Cyrus quickly struck gold in the shape of a small, beat-up book what listed births and deaths for a town with the peculiar name of Scaticook during the years 1850 to 1860. Searching for any entry containing the unusual name Elspeth, Cyrus found one not under the name Fraser, but Franklin, which had been the father's handle. It was the mother who, it seemed, bore the name Libby Hatch had used when she moved to Stillwater. "Do you mean they weren't married?" Miss Howard asked Cyrus, as we all gathered around to look over his shoulders at the faded pages of the record book. "Libby's illegitimate?" Cyrus shrugged. "That might explain a few things about her behavior. And it ought to be easy enough to confirm. Stevie, wake our friend up." Cyrus threw a thumb in the direction of the dozing clerk, "and tell him we'll need the marriage records for the same town covering, say, the 10 years previous to... what's the date of her birth? March 18th, 1858. 10 years previous to that." "Got it," I said, running over to the clerk's counter and rousting him by banging my hands on the surface of the thing where he'd nestled his lazy head on a few books. Grumbling and cursing as he got to his feet, the mug dragged himself off to fetch the requested item, which turned out to be another small, dusty record book. I ran it back over to Miss Howard, who sat beside Cyrus, and quickly started examining it, looking for any mention of people named either Franklin or Fraser. "Here it is," she said, after about 10 minutes of searching. "Formalization of a common law marriage, George Franklin and Clementine Fraser, April 22, 1852.
"There's two other children listed here," Cyrus said, still going over his volume. "George Jr., born September of 1852, and Elijah, born 2 years later."
"Well," Miss Howard said, looking almost disappointed, "there goes the bastard theory. It looks as though she simply adopted her mother's maiden name as an alias when she left home." "And how do we find out when that was?" I asked. "Supposing we can locate the parents, I mean." "We know that she was working for the Muhlenbergs in 1886, Miss Howard answered. "We could check the 1880 census. That'll narrow things down a bit." "On it," I said, heading back over to the clerk's counter. The man heard me coming this time and jerked his head up before I had a chance to give him another start. And when he reappeared from some faraway corner behind the counter, he evened things up some by dropping an enormous book onto my hands. Yelping as I grabbed the thing and turned to carry it away, I mumbled, "Nothing like a government job for improving your sense of humor, huh?" Then went back to the others. From the 1880 census, we learned that Libby Hatch had in fact still been living with her family in that year when she would have been 21. We also learned that George Franklin's occupation had been farmer, no thundering shock, and that the two Franklin boys were also still living at home, where they worked as hands for their old man. The only other question what we figured could be answered in the records office was whether or not Libby had ever been married while she was living in Rensselaer County. Another check of wedding records, though, came up blank, leaving us wondering if she'd taken the vows in some other county in the years between 1880 and 1886, or if the kid we knew she must have given birth to had been born out of wedlock. We got no help with this last mystery from the birth records for those years, which didn't mention anybody named either Franklin or Fraser bringing any babies into the world. And so, with all those questions still hanging in the air, we returned our pile of books and files to the clerk and headed back to the train station. We caught the 4 o'clock local back to Ballston Spa, and the trip turned out to be a pretty merry and exciting one, given the information we'd come up with. True, there was every chance it would lead nowhere. It was impossible to say what the fortunes of the Franklin family had been in the years since 1880. I still thought the odds were even that Libby had done the whole bunch in, but at least now we had a legitimate place to start a reasonable search. Anxious to let the doctor and the others know all this, we raced up the hill from the Ballston train depot to the courthouse once we reached town, only to find that court had already adjourned. So it was on down to Mr. Picton's house at what became a dead run to spread the word that hope for new information wasn't dead yet. But we found that this news didn't encourage the rest of our troops much, given what had gone on in court during the day. As expected, Mr. Darrow had opened the defense's case with his three experts, who'd each done their level best to reinforce the jury's already strong inclination to find Libby Hatch not guilty. Albert Hamilton, the snake oil salesman turned forensics expert, had managed to lay out enough confusing information about guns and bullets to make Lucius's testimony seem, if not mistaken, at least unprovable. To start with, he'd said, the slug what the state had found in the Hatch's wagon might have come from Daniel Hatch's Colt, or it might not have, because there was no central registry for firearms, just as Lucius and Marcus had told us, and because the Colt Peacemaker had been such a popular model of revolver for so many years, the odds that the bullet had in fact come from some other gun were nothing close to the million to one what Lucius had estimated. As for the identifying marks on the missile itself, Hamilton took great pains to explain just how high production standards at Samuel Colt's factory were and how the specifications of every piece turned out were consistent with all those of the same model. Even the nick inside the muzzle of Hatch's gun, what produced the small mark on the bullets that we'd seen, could have been the result of a factory defect, Dr. Hamilton said, a defect shared by dozens and maybe hundreds of other peacemakers. Mr. Picton, on cross-examination, had asked how a factory, what had such high production standards, could turn out hundreds of revolvers with the same muzzle flaw, a question what Hamilton hadn't been able to answer. But incompetent as the man obviously was to anybody who knew anything about ballistics, he'd done a lot of damage with the layman of the jury, and Mr. Darrow's claim that the state's ballistic evidence was untrustworthy had seemed proved. As for the doctor's associate, William Allenson White, it had been his job to dispute the state's contention that a sane woman could plan and carry out the murders of her own children. And he had, it seemed, seen to his task pretty effectively. He was helped by the fact that during his career he hadn't dabbled much in the psychology of family relationships, certainly not in the controversial way what the doctor and others of his breed, like Dr. Adolf Meyer, had. Because White's business was pretty strictly criminals and their mental disorders, he was seen from the beginning as less peculiar than the doctor and therefore more trustworthy.
On top of that, he hadn't done any direct personal work with Clara Hatch, a fact what under ordinary circumstances might have made him look something less than fully informed, but what in this troubling, topsy-turvy case made him seem more detached and reliable. On being asked by Mr. Darrow for his educated opinion about Clara's mental condition, Dr. White had answered that he didn't really believe that the memories of a girl who'd been through such an ordeal, and who was still, after all, very young, could be relied on. Such was what the jury wanted to hear. It was a lot easier than accepting that what Clara had said was true. And so they'd seemed to ignore Dr. White's own statements about not being an expert on kids, and accepted the rest of what he had to say. The main part of his testimony, though, had focused on Libby Hatch herself, and on the notion of whether she was capable of the crime what the state had charged her with. Dr. White said that after spending some 3 hours with the woman, he'd formed the same opinion as Dr. Kreitzler, that Libby, though emotional and impulsive, was free from any mental disease and was, especially as far as the legal definition of the word went, sane. But the conclusion Dr. White drew from this was the opposite of what Dr. Kreitzler's had been. Libby's sanity was a very strong indication, if not outright proof, that she couldn't have shot her kids. In his experience, he said, there were only 3 reasons women committed such crimes: insanity, poverty, or the children being illegitimate. Since none of these reasons was in extreme evidence in this case, the state's explanation of what had happened was not credible. The very character of the crime, Dr. White had said, using words Mr. Picton had found so outrageous he'd written them down, is sufficient to warrant a diagnosis of mental disease. Libby Hatch had no mental disease, so, using logic what, again, was flawed to professional ears but very appealing to a jury, she couldn't have done it. But what about all the other cases what Mr. Picton and Dr. Kreitzler had brought up, Mr. Darrow had then asked, cases involving women who'd unquestionably murdered their own children and been found sane by courts and juries? What about Lydia Sherman, for instance? Lydia Sherman, Dr. White had replied, had unfortunately committed her crimes during a time when mental science was in a much more primitive state. On top of that, people had been so disgusted by the killings that Queen Poisoner had been accused of, and there had been so much evidence and so many witnesses to speak against her, that the possibility of her getting a fair trial, much less being found mentally incompetent, had been about zero. The alienists of the time had been too unsophisticated to understand what had been wrong with the woman, and the public had been desperate for revenge. This was Dr. White's simple explanation for why Lydia Sherman's fate had been sealed. Mr. Darrow had then asked Dr. White if, in his opinion, this injustice was now being repeated, maybe even outdone by the state of New York's attempt to convict and execute Libby Hatch. Yes, Dr. White had solemnly answered. In fact, since Libby Hatch was, in his opinion, innocent, the injustice was even greater. Finally, there'd been Mrs. Cady Stanton to seal the deal for the defense. Mr. Darrow's questioning of her had been particularly clever. As a lifelong battler for women's rights, he'd asked, didn't Mrs. Cady Stanton feel that members of her sex had to accept all of the burdens as well as the advantages of equality? Didn't she think that they shouldn't be allowed to hide behind their skirts to use their gender as an excuse or even an explanation for certain crimes? Of course, Mrs. Cady Stanton had said, and if the crime Libby Hatch had been accused of had been anything other than murdering her own children, the old suffragist wouldn't have bothered traveling to Ballston Spa to give testimony. But in this one thing, childbirth and parenting, she said, men and women were not and never could be equal. Repeating what she'd told us when she came to number 808 Broadway, Mrs. Cady Stanton had lectured the jury and the galleries about the divine creative power of women that was made manifest in the connection between a mother and child. If that power was used for evil purposes, she said, it could not be the woman's doing. After all, no woman could possibly betray a force what, being divine, was greater than her own will.
No, if a woman did commit violence against her own child, it was either because she was insane or because the society of men had forced her into it somehow. Probably both. This last point was tough for Mr. Picton to argue on cross-examination, for he, during his time with Dr. Kreitzer, had come to understand how very much Libby Hatch's actions might indeed have been affected by the society of men. But both Mr. Picton and the doctor held that, such effects aside, Libby was still legally responsible for her own actions. And Mr. Picton had asked Mrs. Katie Stanton if she didn't agree. No, she'd answered, throwing the doctor a look what said that, though she wasn't allowed to speak of it, she did believe that he was involved in some kind of mysterious witch hunt. No, she said, a woman so harried and hounded as to be capable of murdering her own children must certainly have been driven insane, certainly legally insane, meaning unaware of the nature of her acts or that they were wrong, by man's society. And since neither the prosecution's nor the defense's expert mental witnesses had found Libby to in fact be insane, she could not have committed the crimes. It had taken only a day to get all this testimony in, and measured as a whole it represented, Mr. Picton said, further proof, not that we needed any, that Mr. Darrow was truly the master of arguing in the negative. Without ever putting his client on the stand, always a dangerous thing for the defense to do in a murder trial, he'd managed to tear apart the state's assertions with logic what was so turned around, ass backwards even, that it seemed to make some kind of sense. Confused at first, the jury'd slowly become convinced, and all Mr. Picton's desperate efforts to point out that it was plain verbal trickery to say that someone had to be innocent just because they were sane while the crime they were accused of was insane just made him look, as he'd said the night before, like the voice of an older age. Mr. Darrow's reverse and negative logic had the feel of a new century, of modern thinking, and so, indeed, it was. But as Mr. Picton had also said the night before, being new didn't make it any more honorable or respectable, just more effective with juries, which in the end, I suppose, is the only thing what most lawyers have ever considered progress. Mr. Darrow hadn't yet closed his case, and he could, theoretically, call Libby Hatch to the stand on Monday if he wanted to. But there really wasn't any reason for it. Her little performance when Clara had been on the stand had been more effective than any testimony she might give about how much she cared for her children. And allowing Mr. Picton a shot at her during cross-examination, the state wasn't itself allowed to call the defendant, could only lead to trouble. No, from Mr. Darrow's point of view, it was better to keep her where she was, the teary-eyed widow and loving mother at the defense table, whose life had been scarred by terrible losses and tragedies, and who, for all her heroic attempts to overcome a sea of troubles, was now being persecuted by a state government embarrassed by its failure to solve an old and savage crime, and an alienist bent on restoring his reputation. It wasn't hard, then, to see why the news we brought back from Troy offered so little in the way of consolation to our friends. The question of what in her past had made Libby Hatch the woman she was today, or on the night she'd shot her three children, appeared to be a ship what had already sailed. As Marcus had said the night before, the jury was past caring about any psychological explanations of what context had produced a normal, sane girl who would one day be capable of murdering her own children. In fact, they were past believing that she had murdered her children in the first place. And if we tried to introduce such testimony, we'd just be grasping at air. The only useful thing, it seemed, that might come out of the search was if Libby had committed some other violent act during the years before she'd gone to the Muhlenbergs, and we could find some way to tie that act to the present proceedings. That possibility seemed pretty remote, though, to everybody. Everybody except, again, Miss Howard, who just refused to give up on whatever horse she was riding until it was good and dead. And so, early Saturday morning, she had the four of us who'd made the Troy trip up and aboard Mr. Picton's Surrey. The doctor had wanted to come along, but he felt a personal responsibility to head out to the Westons' farm that day and see how Clara was doing. The town of Scaticoke was located about half a dozen miles inland from the east bank of the Hudson, which meant another ferry crossing and another monotonous ride through farm country that wasn't much different from the territory we'd covered in Saratoga and Washington counties. We arrived in the place to find that the locals were getting a few big fields ready for the Rensselaer County Fair, a fact what made the general atmosphere, along with the attitudes of the town's residents, more cheery than they likely were ordinarily. We didn't have to ask but a few people about the Franklin farm before we found one helpful old soul who gave us very exact instructions on how to get there. The spread lay to the east of the town, alongside a shadowy back road, what was painful to travel, and what made Miss Howard and me figure that we were on our way to yet another gloomy house haunted by the ghost.